The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Where we start, though, is with our panel, Michelle Murphy, Research and Policy Analyst at Social Justice Ireland, Larry Donnelly, Law Lecturer at University of Galway and columnist with The Journal, and Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin. And on the topic of the last election, there's the first sort of major poll after the last election, looking at the state of the parties, looking at the state of the presidency, because that's what we're heading into at some point this year is a presidential election, and looking at general opinions, moods and feelings across all. Lynn Boylan, let me start with you, because, of course, you are in one of the parties featured in the poll, that being Sinn Féin, 19.3%, more or less sort of where you were. You've had Christmas, dust has settled. You've had a chance to lick wounds if they are there and figure out what to do after the election. Where do you now stand, and where has the navel gazing brought you?
Well, I think what Sinn Féin is looking at is we've had a break now over the Christmas. People are well rested and are looking forward to actually getting going again, and, you know, have criticised the length of time it's taken for government formation. So look, the poll, everything's within the margin of error. That's not surprising, given that there hasn't been very much politics as such. But we're ready to go in and to, I suppose, represent the communities that have elected us, who have, I suppose, looked as wanting an alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And that's the challenge we have, is to put forward that credible alternative, that whenever there is another general election, that people can believe that there is an alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Now, you, your party representative said, following the locals and the general, that there was something of a challenge in getting your message to land, and that you needed to go and give some consideration to how it was that that engagement didn't deliver in the way that you'd hoped. Do you have answers to that question?
Well, you'll see those answers when we're performing in the Dáil and the Shannon team that we have. I mean, look, as politicians, the key thing is to be able to communicate the message to the electorate. So it's one is not just holding the government to account, which we will do. And look, to my own view is that a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, an independent government is going to be a disaster. We're going to be talking, I think, about climate change later on in the show, but looking at independents going in who are trying to push back on climate measures, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who are not going to do anything different in terms of housing, that is a disaster, particularly for young people who are trying to put stable roof over their head. So our job is to, one, hold them to account, but also, I suppose, is to sell that message that there is an alternative. And that's why we really want to work with the other members of the opposition parties to put forward that credible alternative to the electorate.
Normally in this kind of situation, what you see a party do is some reshuffling, some new faces, some fresh blood to try to rebuild. Because obviously when you lose momentum, it's a very difficult thing to get going. Are we likely to see that, do you think?
Well, you'd have to have Mary Lou MacDonald on. That's in her gift, is around the reshuffle.
But you must have a sense of the mood.
Well, what I would say is that there are spokespeople who are very well across their brief. What we want now is people who are very well across their brief. I mean, looking at the poll results, housing, health, healthcare, climate, they're all still key issues for the electorate. So I think, in my own view, it would be foolish to be moving people from those positions, even if I have a conflict of interest there. But I think that people who are across their brief, you don't want someone going in and having to read up on those. You want someone to be able to hit the ground running, especially if we're going to have the same minister in the government, you know, to be able to kind of know where the faults are and to hold him to account, because he's clearly not intending on doing what the Housing Commission called for, which was a radical reset on housing policy.
In terms of knowing that we are likely to have the same minister in government, Larry, it has been so thoroughly leaked at this point where the planning is, that we pretty much, unless the leaks are lying to us, we have a fairly clear sense of what this is going to look like at this point, don't we?
Yeah, I think we do. I think we have a general sense of what it's going to look like. And, you know, we know that this group of independents are going to, you know, and I suppose the final thing is, I suppose, sorting out exactly which portfolio is going where. And as you say,
on that note, I have to say that the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday has one of the great "you don't say" headlines, which is "Healy Rays would take a ministry if offered one."
Yeah, very.
Take two if offered two as well.
Very interesting. It was a Seamus Brennan who said about staying bought or something like that. But so that'll be interesting as well. But I think the overarching point here is talking to the ordinary people on the street and also looking at the geopolitical challenges that are on the horizon. I don't think the people are going to thank Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, and or indeed the independents, if this takes too long. I think that Micheál Martin and Simon Harris are very acutely aware of that. So I think that the government will be up and running ASAP. And I think, you know, look, at the idea is to, you know, a Trump presidency, all these other challenges. The mantra of the government parties was, look, you know, stability. We need to have, you know, good people in the room, people who know what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a good segment of the electorate bought into that.
Well, you see that sense of alacrity. I saw a statement from Vincent Brown, I think pretty much a day or two after the election, that more or less said, lads, if you get together, you know, knock heads, get in a room, pay some good, strong attention. You could have this done in a week and we could have the government together before Christmas. And it's now a month on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tend to agree with Vincent Brown's analysis. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of wise old heads saying this isn't simple and there are big egos at play. And I take those points on board. But these are politicians, after all, and they're answerable to the people. And if they are in touch with the public mood is, we got you back into office because we bought into the stability mantra. So let's get back in and get to business. And I think that's what people want. And if the government parties dilly-dally or are perceived to dilly-dally or take too long on that, the people aren't going to thank them.
To some extent, Michelle, this is turning into, do you remember the end of 2024 was defined by a six-week, deeply frustrating period of when will the election be? We're starting 2025 with a deeply frustrating period of when will the government form? They could get on with it, couldn't they?
I mean, they could. What's interesting actually about that poll, which might focus some minds today, is the drop in support for independence, which is substantial. Like, it's beyond the margin of error. So that shows people's annoyance. I mean,
We voted for you to be an independent voice in your race to the government.
Yes. So I think that should focus their minds. And the other issue is, I mean, I read the manifestos. I mean, I had to as part of my job. If you compare the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, they're not hugely different. So I don't really see how it's taken them. I mean, since 2016, they've been together in some form or another. Mm. It shouldn't be taking them this long. And I mean, as Larry said, you hear about the challenges. Will we be there by the 22nd? Will we? Won't we? I mean, at this,
the 22nd is seen as a deadline by virtue of Trump coming in as president. We're using that as a sort of
they set that date. So they had a vote in the Dáil to postpone to the 22nd to give them time.
Set that deadline for themselves, which, you know, they may or may not end up regretting it. But I suppose what's interesting to me is you look at the issues that have come up in the poll. So housing, obviously, is there. Healthcare is up, I think, 8%. Cost of living is up. You've poverty at nearly 10%. Climate at 10%. So, like, these are issues that they're going to have to get to grips with. Now, reading the two manifestos of the two main parties, I don't really see what they're going to do on housing that's any different. And that should really be worrying them, given the reports we've had in the 2 weeks on the increase in the cost.
But did they not to some extent campaign on that basis, that what they were going to do in respect of housing was more of the same as fast as they can do it?
And yes, but are they getting the delivery out there? And I suppose that's the problem with housing. If you have a home, it's not an issue for you, but it's a huge issue for those people who are stuck in the rental market or those 15,000 plus people.
Although it's interesting, in the poll in Berlin, it's the only one of the topics. I mean, the top four topics being housing, cost of living, healthcare and immigration. But it is the only one of those that carries a majority. Most people still see that as the prime issue.
Of housing, absolutely, and it is, because it feeds into every other aspect of your life.
Do you know what I mean? It's driving the wages, the shortage of teachers.
It's driving Garda numbers, like Garda leaving because they can't afford to live on the salary. So it has knock-on impacts. Even, I mean, when you have the likes of IBEC and big companies saying housing is a big challenge for them as well, I mean, that shows you how bad the situation has got. But I mean, the delay in forming government is clearly just around personalities and carving up jobs for the boys. Which is, you know, is very frustrating for people who, like that, are struggling to save, to get a deposit.
Is that overly cynical? Because what they say is you need to sit down and do the manifestos, you need to see where there are alignment, where there isn't. You then need to look at the layout of the government departments and what shifts you're going to make on that. And then you have to look at appointments and the deals with the independents, and that's a process that they time.
But they've been in government together more or less for 10 years. I mean, like, so there isn't much difference. Even the electorate thinks 75% says there's no difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So, like, the only thing they really should be negotiating is what ministries they're giving to the independents who are going to make up the numbers. And that is why the independents have taken a big hit, because people thought independents were going to be independent of government.
But you do, I mean, you do have to take the time to do that, and the ministries. But I suppose the challenge for them now, and it came out in that poll, has it moved to such a point that it's seen as there is a kingmaker among one group, and a large proportion of the public aren't happy with that. you know, and I think that is going to be a challenge for both Micheál Martin and Simon Harris.
Sorry, when you say they're not, when you're referring to the kingmaker in one group?
So one of the questions in the poll there, I think, is with regard to Michael Lowry, and I think 60%.
Do you think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael should be dealing with independent TD Michael Lowry in light of the findings of the Moriarty Tribunal and his convictions for tax offences? And the answer is 63% of people saying no.
Yes. So I think that's going to be a challenge for them now in the coming weeks, how they manage.
There's an interesting, there's a fair amount of analysis of whether or not Michael Lowry should be involved as the Svengali. We'll come back to this in a second. Larry, you wanted to come
I just want to make a point, and we're talking a lot about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the independents. Housing is obviously still the biggest issue. And whether it's on housing, whether it's on cost of living, whether it's on health, one of the big questions I have is how well the opposition parties are going to cohere. I think Sinn Féin, the Sock Dems, Labour, some of the harder left groupings, how well are they going to cohere as an opposition to
Do they need to cohere?
Well,
if they were moving into government, they do, but in opposition, do they?
But if they want to pose an alternative, specifically a left alternative to the government, then I think it's incumbent upon them, because I think one of the dynamics we saw emerge from the election is that people who are generally comfortable, people who generally are happy with their economic and other situation, voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and in some instances, independents. And how well the left then is going to try to capture, again, as Lynn says, people who are really struggling, especially to get on the housing ladder. I think that's going to be a very important consideration for Sinn Féin, Labour, Sock Dems, etc.
Do you agree, Lynn, or is the Sinn Féin view go paddle our own canoe and see where we get to be by the next election?
No, I don't agree with forming sort of blocks in terms of electoral pacts going into elections, because I think the nature of our system with PR, that doesn't work. It makes sense where you have a list system, do you mean, to maximise the number of returned who have similar politics. Where I do think that there is room for progress is around, we now have a solid block on the opposition benches of that are representing people who are clearly feeling that they've been left behind or are not represented by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the independents, who are now going to prop them up. And I suppose where we have got similar views on similar issues and those big ticket items, I do think that we could work together and cooperate together on the opposition benches. And that then, I suppose, allows for whenever there is another general election. And look, it might not go 5 years. I mean, now that the file on Michael Lowry is going to the DPP, who knows what's going to happen? So I think we do need to be able to put forward that proposal of there is an alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which is what we had said going into the election. Our preference was always for a government without those two parties. We need to now demonstrate that that is a credible option.
On the topic of the file on Michael Lowry going to the DPP, can you remember how long it is since the Moriarty Tribunal A began and B finished? I mean, it must have begun.
Did it begin in 2001? Was it 2001, I think?
Was it there? Can you remember?
It's somewhere in that neck of the woods.
Yeah. By God, it's some wait for the Gardaí to do anything on the basis
DPP.
Of it.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you make, Larry, of the poll finding that two-thirds of people nearly said that Michael Lowry should have no role in this? Because Michael Lowry had a period where he was very much rehabilitated. I mean, Bertie Ahern handed out olive branches. I think Michael Noonan at one point, no, it was John Bruton, indicated that it would be un-Christian to not let him back into the party. Suddenly, everybody seems to have remembered the breathtaking corruption of his relationship with Ben Dunn and more.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why the timing of all of this is kind of curious in a way. Look, I don't think it's hugely surprising given what's in the public domain about Michael Lowry that people feel that way. But I mean, you have to look at it another way. Michael Lowry is the ultimate political survivor. I mean, he's around an awful long time. He gets a massive, massive vote in his constituency. And not only that, because he has supported governments through thick and thin, he has extraordinary access to power, and he has for a considerable amount of time. So a very shrewd, able, cagey politician. The morality of it one way or the other, people will take different views on that topic, but I'm not surprised by the top line figure but I don't think it's going to play a really significant role.
Lynn?
Well, I found it fascinating listening to Simon Harris during the week on Michael Lowry. And look, the people of Tipperary can elect Michael Lowry all they want, and that's the democratic process. It's very different to then accept somebody going into government, actually governing the country. And I think that's reflected then in the poll, that people are deeply uncomfortable with that. But for Simon Harris to sort of go, it's up to the independents who they put forward to nominate, taking this very passive position, you know, which he had done during the election as well. He became a commentator on issues as if to say someone should do something about this. He is currently the, you know, the Taoiseach at the moment. Do you mean he's the sitting Taoiseach? He's the one who's going in and negotiating alongside the tarnished and Micheál Martin. So yes, it is absolutely up to those two parties who they talk to and who they sit down to talk to and who they accept as the lead negotiator. So it is a bit bizarre for Simon Harris to sort of take this hands-off role, going, oh, well, it's nothing to do with us. That's who they've nominated. They know Michael Lowry's past. They have called for him to resign in the past. You know, there's a dull motion calling for him to resign. So they're doing this with their eyes wide open. And I think that the electorate hopefully can see that, and it's reflected in their views in the poll that they're not comfortable with it.
Whatever about the Moriarty Tribunal's findings in respect of Michael Lowry and his relationship with Dennis O'Brien and what they described as his insidious and pervasive influence in the securing of the mobile phone license. Does, in real politic terms, does the either main party in the government have a choice? If the independents say, look, it's talk to Michael or talk to nobody, and he's an elected TD, do they get to climb onto the high moral ground and say, we're not going to speak to him?
Well, they had options, I mean, to talk to other parties as well. They don't have to go in with the independents. So they could have spoken to other parties, but equally they're in a strong position with the numbers that they have to say, we're not going to do business with you, and see then what the other independents will do. They didn't do that. They didn't even try to play hardball and say, no, we won't negotiate with Michael Lowry. We want to negotiate with somebody else.
Larry?
I think realistically speaking, the answer to your question is no, they didn't have any other choice. And I think if there were another choice that were palatable, I think they probably would have availed of it, because Micheál Martin and Simon Harris are both acutely aware of what they've said in the past, and acutely aware that the press and the opposition were going to hold that out, and that it was going to be awkward for them. So if they had any other viable, realistic option, I think they would have taken it.
The other thing that the poll looks at in the Sunday Independent, Michelle Murphy, is the likely makeup of the runners and riders for the presidential election and who is going to come out on top. And fair play to them, they've done the hard yards of proportional representation, because they've run it not just who would you vote for, but who would you vote for in each round, so we can see who might win. Weirdly, Tommy Tiernan comes, I think, third or fourth.
Yes.
Am I missing something? Is there even the smallest snowballs of Tommy Tiernan running, or is somebody just saying this for the crack?
I mean, you'd have to ask Tommy, but I suppose he's got name recognition. And look, the presidential election, it's one of those elections where it is down to, it's going to be personality based as well. So, I mean, there is a very large field of candidates, which they have, you know, gone through. I think it's 13 rounds they've gone through with. I think Michael McDougall poll as well, Mairead McGuinness.
How do they keep somebody on the phone long enough to do that?
You'd be pretty exhausted. But you've Charlotte Burns in there as well. We've Breed Smith, we've Mary Lou, we've Jonathan Ooken. I think Tommy Tiernan is the only non sort of political person actually in there. You know, Charlotte Burns as well. There's just those two. The rest of them, all of them have some form of connection to, you know, politics or a political party. I find it fascinating just because to see, well, when we see who actually the candidates of the presidential election are, and actually what impact has that had? Because people now talking about Tommy Tiernan as a potential president? Are they saying to him, well, Tommy, you should throw your name in the
hat? Things have happened in recent presidential elections. The end result has our new president being Mairead McGuinness on 34.8%, barely squeaking ahead of Michael McDougall. Lynn, you're around politics a long time. What do you think of the chances of our presidential election finishing neck and neck between Mairead McGuinness and Michael McDougall?
I think, look, the presidential election is one of those ones where names get thrown in and people get suggested for it who have never even considered running. And not to say that, obviously, Mairead McGuinness is very much interested in running. She's been interested in running for about 10 years now. I wouldn't put it past Michael McDougall either to have put his name out there in the mix. But it's a type of an election that it really only matters once the starting gun is fired, because it's probably the closest we get to an American election in that you know, whatever skeletons are in your closet will be thrown out. It's very much a personality about how you connect with the electorate. So I think it's certainly wide open, and who knows even what
what's that line about? What is it about academic politics being being so vicious because they are the results are so meaningless? There's an element same with the presidency. The way that people get traduced. And what will you do for the nation for a job that is essentially stand around, shake hands and occasionally call the Council of State?
Well, it's a very well-paid job. For standing around, if that's the case. It is a very well-paid job. It is important. I mean, and in fairness to the sitting president, Michael D. Higgins, I think has been a fantastic representative for the state and has done the job very well. And, you know, in terms of scrutinising legislation as well, in terms of criticising the speed at which the government parties would rush through legislation before Christmas holidays, before the summer holidays, with no scrutiny, using the guillotine too much in the parliament. So I think he's done a very good job in the role that he has and with the powers that he has. So it is an important job for whoever does it, and it is something that someone needs to take seriously.
Well, I think in terms of this poll,
I think it is one of those ones where it's really when it gets going that you'll start to then be concerned about what polling numbers
we do are. Need to take a break in a second. Just proof that I haven't been paying enough attention to the presidential election by virtue of the cynicism that I have now let go of. Apparently Tommy Tiernan has refused in an article from August last year, quotes, he has refused to comment on speculation that he is considering running for the presidency next year and is being encouraged to do so by the incumbent Michael D. Higgins. It's understood that the popular talk show host has had meetings with Higgins over the summer to discuss the prospect of contesting the election in 2025 and could do so with the outgoing president.
There you go now.
It's an interesting point. One of the things I'd say is that Tiernan, in some ways, in this poll, in my view, is a placeholder in the sense that there is every likelihood that somebody from beyond the world of politics might take a go at this and might have a realistic chance.
Oh, well, sure. You look back at the Sean Gallaghers and the Gavin Duffys, there's always somebody who decides he'll give it a lash. All right, we do need to take a break. Before that, we'll give you a shot at the cash machine.
News Talk's cash machine.
So our last winner was Kevin Granahan. He's planned to get married this year. He was planning to get married anyway. We didn't cause it by helping him win the cash machine, but we're going to fund it because he did win the cash machine amount. That means the cash machine has been reloaded. There's now 111 grand up for grabs. Taking part is easy. We give you a specific amount. You take a note of it. You enter. And if we call you and you give us the right number, you win the money. Cash machine amount, €111,000. Exactly. Text pay to 57557. That's 57557. The cost is €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Live network of stations. Full terms on newstalk.com. Get your entry in by 3 p.m. on January the 17th. And then it could be you that gets the call during Moncrief. Answer within five rings. Tell us the prize amount and you walk away with the money. Prize amount again, €111,000 exactly. You can text play to 57557. Now, after the break, $150 billion is now the estimate of the damage caused by the LA fires. Tens of thousands of homes destroyed, something to the order of 100,000 people displaced. Suggestions that there needs to be rent freezes across all of Southern California because there will be gouging as fire refugees try to find places to live. And whatever houses remain apparently being looted as dozens of arrests are being made. And the blame game has started. We'll discuss that after the break. Fires continue to rage across LA, and the word devastation gets used fairly regularly in relation to a number of things, but it is apt in this context because there is little other way to describe what has happened across the county of LA other than devastating. The Sunday Times with a two-page spread, day by blazing day, how hell engulfed the city of angels. And the blame game has started. It started fairly quickly thanks to Donald Trump, who said Gavin Newsom should resign. This is all his fault. He refused to sign the Water Restoration Declaration. Elon Musk yesterday joining that call, saying that it is thanks to the Democrats and to Gavin Newsom. Before we get to the recriminations and who is to blame, Larry, this is the country of your birth. Watching the footage of 80-100 mile an hour winds ripping through LA, tearing blazing palm trees down, watching cars literally melt and be bulldozed out of the street by the fire department. Extraordinary scenes.
Yeah, it's absolutely heartbreaking. That's the only way to describe it. I don't even think devastation does justice to what has happened. I mean, it's absolutely awful. And, you know, obviously a lot of the coverage has been, you know, what celebrities have lost their houses, et cetera. But my real focus is on the ordinary, regular people who've lived in that area for many, many years. I've seen, heard so many stories and firsthand testimony from different people who've been displaced, and father, parents and grandparents and all, you know, in one apartment because they've all lost their homes. It doesn't bear thinking about. So at a human level, it's just profoundly, profoundly sad. And hopefully now, they get a get some handle on this thing. And again, the monumental task of trying to rebuild and all of that is coming down the pike. And in terms of the recriminations, I think they're wide ranging. I mean, one of the things that already is being debated and discussed is what is to blame here. Some are saying that, look, climate change has set the stage for all of this. People on the political right are saying, no, it's not climate change. It's somebody said it deliberately that this happens regularly, wildfires in California. Again, so that's hard to know. In terms of the political fallout, you know, as you allude to, there's a lot of blame being tossed around. And, you know, who deserves the blame? It's very hard to know. Politicians, of course, when something goes wrong, politicians do get some of the blame. If I would say one thing politically, and again, I'm hesitant to speak politically when there's so much suffering going on. But if I was to make one political point, it is that this has done immeasurable damage to Gavin Newsom's prospects of being the Democratic nominee for president.
Do you think?
I think so, because, look, Newsom was already up against it because I don't know how familiar people here would be with it, but he's the governor of California, which in America is very much seen as a two-edged sword. Yes, you are the CEO of the seventh largest economy in the world, but on the other hand, the majority of Americans view California as something of a failed state. And an incident like this where Newsom, if not totally to blame, I think he does bear some responsibility with water and all that sort of thing. We can get into the detail if you want. But I think this is going to confirm that in the minds of very many people. And I think even Democrats who might be sympathetic to Newsom will say this does real damage to his potential chances of winning the presidency. So sorry to reduce it to politics, but I think Gavin Newsom is the political loser.
Well, I have to say, it's not you, Larry, that is reducing it to politics. It was made political almost instantaneously by Donald Trump. In relation to the cause of it, there's an awful lot of analysis in the papers this weekend. On the climate change topic, one of the theories, Michelle, is that there was 2 years of relatively significant rainfall, which meant a lot of vegetation, followed by a year of drought, which meant all the vegetation went bone dry. I happen to have been riding a motorcycle through that area in this October, just past. It was 46 degrees Celsius coming out of the Mojave in October, which is bizarre. I mean, you would not normally expect that. And it was tinder dry all the way through the LA Hills. Is it that we lay the blame on, or is it lack of fire breaks, poor reservoirs, poor management?
Well, I mean, it's probably a combination, but you can't ignore that piece. I think I read there was 4 millimetres, I think, of rainfall in that area last year. And then, as you said, there was the floods the year before. So you have all this vegetation, it's tinder dry. So unless you have a really strong fire management strategy in terms of burning that vegetation, you know, putting in those troughs, which it doesn't seem to appear they were there, but then you can't control the wind, you know, and the wind speeds. So it's a combination, but I don't think we can ignore the climate change piece overall in terms of things being wetter or drier. And I did see there was a statement from the fire department saying, like, this is not the time of year where they expect fires anyway. This is when you're doing the prep work for the summer fires. But as you said, this is January, you know, and we can't ignore that. And I suppose the challenge is if you make it political and you blame it, which was, a water restoration, it's blamed on an individual, then you never have to deal with the bigger problem. And I think that is going to be really challenging globally.
On the topic of that bigger problem, the human toll of this, Lynn, I mean, when you look at first of all, people trying to rebuild their houses, there won't be a contractor available if you can afford to rebuild a house in Los Angeles County for the next number of years. The permitting process is going to take forever. Trying to get insurance is now going to be almost impossible. Trying to rent a place for the refugees will be extremely difficult because gouging is possible anywhere they go. This is going to have, I assume, a knock-on legacy for months, if not years.
No, absolutely. And I know I heard on one show that I was listening to about the fires around that most of the insurance companies have already gone to the wall, you know, and it's now falling on the state insurance company, the insurer of last resort. And that then, of course, has a knock-on impact for everybody's insurance policies in America.
And of course, it's worth saying that without that policy, without having an insurance, you can't get a mortgage. So if you don't have enough free cash to straight buy a house, you suddenly discover there's no way to build because I can't insure it and I can't get a mortgage.
No, the human toll is going to be immense. But it's like, while it's LA this week, you know, we've had the fires in Greece and the you know, loss of life there. We had Hurricane Katrina, you know, is it 10 years ago?
With Ian 2 years ago in Florida.
We've now had Valencia floods
in Spain.
Extreme weather events are happening across the world, and that is the reality of climate change. These are going to become more frequent, and there's a human cost to that. But there's also, you know, we have to, as all politicians, prepare for climate adaptation, because whether we like it or not, a lot of the carbon emissions are already banked in. So the climate is going to increase. Even if we were to do everything overnight in terms of cutting our emissions, there's warming is already banked in. So we have to be prepared, which means climate adaptation, and that requires investment. I mean, if you look in Ireland, it's 10 years we were promised a flood alert system. And it's never happened. Do you know what I mean? And while we probably won't have the wildfires, we do have some fires in Ireland during the summer months.
And there are some stories in the papers today relating to how prepared we are generally. If you look at this week where we suddenly find ourselves neck deep in snow in a way that is relatively unusual.
And people without water and electricity for up to 5 days. Do you know what I mean? In a very wealthy country. So this is the reality that all of us have to get our heads around, is we have to start preparing for climate adaptation. And it does need investment. You know, and in Ireland, it's particularly, it is going to be floods, but, you know, colder winters as well. And that we've had, okay, we had a very mild Christmas and it was very, very disconcerting to be out walking around at 15 degrees. But with the Gulf Stream changing, shifting its position because of climate change, we are probably going to see more cold snaps like we've seen, and even more extreme cold snaps as the years go on.
The local authorities here that are tasked with the mitigation plans. And look, being a dweller in the Northwest, and we didn't get it too bad until Wednesday. The one thing I think every local authority is going to have to do.
Yeah, Donegal sort of got away scot-free for a while. And all the weather, and all the weather
and
warnings.
The bobsleigh track, Anton, if you're not on a main road. But you're going to have to look at gritting secondary routes.
Yeah.
The majority, I'd say if you did a census of primary schools in particular around the country, how many of them are on secondary routes? And they're simply shut down because secondary routes aren't gritted. And so all of a sudden, you know, you've no school, the main roads are clear. Local authorities, county councils are going to have to look at, you know, they're going to have to look at funding for gritting secondary routes, things like flood management plans, alert systems, because it's going to become more frequent. And I mean, we do get a fair bit of snow and ice up there, and it generally doesn't make the headline news. So there was a bit of amusement, I have to say. Now, it was terrible what happened in parts of the country, but some of the snow, I mean, we had that one day in November when I was due to be here, and I woke up in the morning and I was like, oops. But it went, you know.
Mid-air get an awful end of the stick.
And they did actually get some political stick.
I was travelling to Cork, and there was you could hear a discussion on the radio of, oh, well, it's not that bad. And you got on the train out of Houston, you got outside the pale.
Yeah, and you see,
wow.
But it's why it's really unfortunate to see politicians try and play that far-right playbook of now attacking weather alerts. I mean, if weather alerts have saved an older person breaking their hip or their ankle and then blocking up hospitals. Do you know what I mean? So, look, the weather alerts, there's an element of your own personal responsibility, but it is important to check in, to hear those weather alerts and go, do you know what, if I don't need to leave the house, it's probably better, and that helps the healthcare system. Do you know what I mean? So all of these things
also,
are important.
Mid-air, don't come around to the house and lock your front door.
No,
they're giving you a heads up. You make your own informed choice.
But this is the ridiculousness of criticising them. They're doing their job, and we would be the first to criticise them if they didn't give us a warning.
Exactly.
While we're on the topic of the right-wing reaction to weather alerts, we're going to talk more about the swing to the right, because it's getting very interesting with what has happened with Mark Zuckerberg during the week and his shift to the right. We saw it earlier with content moderation. We see it now with him taking a stand against the feminization of corporate America, and Steve Bannon and Elon Musk look to be falling at each other's throats because of Musk not being sufficiently committed to the right wing, which is Bannon is the only person in the world to think that. We'll discuss that after this break. We're seeing a significant shift to the right in the public discourse in the US and in the public discourse in social media companies based in the US. Obviously, we saw it happen a couple of months ago with what was once Twitter. We see it now happening with Meta and Mark Zuckerberg, and that, of course, means Facebook and it means WhatsApp. Zuckerberg has not only changed the content moderation policies of the social media giant for which he is responsible, but he's also trying to change the corporate culture, because he feels that over the last number of years, I'm paraphrasing somewhat, but not by much, you know, the insidious feminization of American corporate culture is something that he wants to take a stand against. Here's what he had to say on Joe Rogan.
Like, I do think that if you're a woman going into a company, it probably feels like it's too masculine. It's right. Like there isn't enough of the kind of the energy that you may naturally have. And it probably feels like there are all these things that are set up that are biased against you. But I think these things can always go a little far. It's one thing to say we want to be kind of like welcoming and make a good environment for everyone. And I think it's another to basically say that masculinity is bad. And I just think we kind of swung culturally to that part of the spectrum where, you know, it's all like, okay, masculinity is toxic. We have to like get rid of it completely. It's like, no, like it's both of these things are good, right? It's like you want like feminine energy, you want masculine energy. Like you're going to have parts of society that have more of one or the other. I think that that's all good. But I do think the corporate culture sort of had swung towards being this somewhat more neutered thing.
And hand in hand with that, Meta appointed to its board Dana White, the man who is the chief of the UFC and a man who hit his wife repeatedly in public and made a subsequent apology because of it. But it goes to the cultural shift and views that Meta now has. Lynn Boylan, this is a man who is one of the richest men in the world. He's one of the most influential men in the world. He is somebody who controls a company that contributes as much to the global discourse as almost any other entity. It's worrying times if you're a woman or a minority, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, and it kind of shows you that Mark Zuckerberg is interested in one thing only, and that's in finance and money that he can make. Do you know what I mean? And
how much do you need, though?
Well, that's another question. And I would say billionaires shouldn't exist. If a tax system was effective, we wouldn't have billionaires. But he is clearly just interested in what's going to generate revenue on his platform. And he's looking around and seeing that there is that audience out there to drive that far-right narrative. You know, nobody is saying masculinity is bad, actually. Do you know what I mean? Masculinity is fine. It's the toxic masculinity, as you said, an individual who beats his wife in public. Do we want to go back to the old days of the office where, you know, someone can slap you on the arse? Do you know what I mean? That's not what we want. So it's this, but he's clearly doing it purely to generate revenue. And that's where...
But hand in hand with this, Meta has reversed or altered some of its diversity programs, some of its inclusion programs, some of its attempts to rebalance its gender targets within the company. So this goes to obviously a policy change in respect of no longer will Meta, as a representative large employer, want to be trying to drive equal representation for women and men.
No, he doesn't want to drive it because he's seeing that to generate revenue is to take it in the opposite direction. And so if you have your workforce, then you want a workforce that's going to actually implement that policy of generating far-right discourse. The issue here is that we have allowed these social media companies to become as influential and as important as they are. And that's where it falls back again to legislators to do their job and to regulate them and to fine them very heavily if they are, you know, found to be wrongdoing. You know, this is not the first time Mark Zuckerberg has been in the news. We saw that with the Brexit debate, you know what I mean, and the influence of Facebook and Cambridge Analytics at that time. So it's not like we haven't seen this before.
Who said that they needed to tackle that? It was he who said that they needed to moderate content. It was he who said they had a moral responsibility. He is arguing now with himself.
But he's looking over his shoulder at Musk and what Musk is doing on Twitter or X or whatever he wants to call it now, and is seeing that that's obviously that's where the tide is going. So I'm going to follow that, and that's why these individuals can't be trusted to regulate themselves and regulators have to regulate.
Like, Michelle Murphy, there is an argument that says this is meritocracy. Survival of the fittest. If you are the person best placed to get the job, you'll get the job. If you are, if you have an opinion, you have a right to express that opinion. And all that they are doing is saying, let the market decide, free rein to those who merit it most.
Well, I suppose he's not really saying let the market decide what he's doing. Like, he's just completely changed company policy. And I suppose reading through this, what's quite concerning should be really concerning is they've had that challenge in terms of news and Facebook and newspaper content. So now he's saying that, he doesn't like engaging with the traditional press. He prefers podcasts because you get a sea change in terms of whose voices matter. That should be really concerning. So basically he is saying the free press, or what like they like to call the mainstream media, cannot be trusted. That should be really concerning. And it is like a culture shift, or he's shifting his company because he's looking at where the wind is blowing for the next 5 years. But, they, and it, in the poll, in the Sunday Independent poll, which I found really interesting, I think it's 80-something percent of people think, you know, these companies need to be regulated and legislated for. And they also think a large proportion of Irish politicians shouldn't actually be on X anymore. I can't remember the number, but I thought that was really interesting. But it's, he's shifting the ground because he's looking at where the wind is blowing for the next 5 years. But I think more concerning is this, you know, he's amplifying this thing that what's wrong with the traditional press, that they might ask you some questions and they might do a bit of research. Actually,
that's good. Are you still on X?
I am still on X, yeah. I mean, like, the issue is you have a platform and you've built up a long-standing kind of following, but also you follow individuals. So it is very hard to shift from that. But I have also set up the Blue Sky account. But the nature of the job is that you're there and it takes years of building up. And I mean, you found contacts on X that you wouldn't have found otherwise.
Well, hang on for a second. Larry, can you take a view on that as a microcosm for the issue that the EU faces? Because Musk has said that he wants to work with Donald Trump to effectively have a go at EU regulation and to try to get it rolled back so that it can be a total free-for-all for Meta in Europe. Presumably the challenge for European regulators and for the Commission is the same that Lynn describes. If they are that embedded in European society, very difficult to take them on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think what lies at the heart of a lot of this in terms of social media and the discourse and everything else, and what's allowed and what's not allowed, is what I've seen unfold myself many times, is the lawyers on both sides of the Atlantic, where in the United States, the lawyers would have an absolutist First Amendment view of free speech where absolutely anything goes. Whereas here, there's a much different view taken towards freedom of expression and what goes one way or the other.
Although we do have to remind ourselves, it isn't just about freedom of expression. Algorithms make editorial choices about what they present. So it isn't just that you post it. It is that the company decides to amplify it or not. That's an editorial intervention, albeit automatic.
That's absolutely true. And that's where, you know, regulation obviously has to play a very big role in all of this. The one thing I would quickly add just on Zuckerberg's pivot, and I take on board absolutely this is a cash decision and how much money do you need and all that. But the other thing to be mindful of is don't forget that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook kicked Donald Trump off there. And Donald Trump said not so long ago, Zuckerberg better watch himself because we're going to be looking over his shoulder. And if he pulls anything else, we're going to go after him.
Now,
so it's not just money. It's the fact that he was under threat from Trump.
Member of the European Parliament, Lynn Boylan, let me ask you then. It is going to be a significant challenge for the EU to find itself in a regulatory battle facing possible tariff wars if we go down that route. Is there enough cohesion in the European Union to deal with these kind of issues in a concerted way and in a way that requires a bit of spine?
Well, the current makeup of the Parliament isn't very cohesive. That is an issue with you know, proposed legislation coming through. But there's laws there already. So the Digital Services Act is there, GDPR is there, and the European Commission needs to show backbone in taking on these companies. So what Zuckerberg needs to do is to actually bring forward a risk assessment if he's going to change content moderation. That's part of the Digital Services Act.
But we've seen Elon Musk interfering in German politics, in UK politics.
It's where the European Commission has to show the backbone, because the legislation is there. They have to enforce the legislation. They're the body that does that. It's not the European Parliament. And I would say that the problem at the EU, and it's been a long-standing problem, is that there's second to Washington, it's the most lobbied institution in the world. So there is a problem there around corporate lobbying and the revolving door of lobbyists. But the other key thing that I would say, and that the EU could be doing, but both and also our own government, is investing in journalism and investing in what Zuckerberg is calling traditional media, because people need to be able to have somewhere they can go that they can trust. Podcasts are great. We all listen to podcasts, but you still need to be able to go and trust the media that you have. And we've had this government promise that they would invest in media, in print media, and we haven't seen that lived up to. You know, we have, 19 local radio stations, 39 local newspapers. They need support in some way, and it's not about editorial decisions.
Although, of course, people will say that as soon as you do that, you end up capturing them by virtue of funding.
There's a lot of European countries have funds that are, you know, completely independent, but they support investigative journalism or support fact checking, and that it's journalists apply through that independent fund. There's ways to do it to avoid editorial.
Just quickly on that EU-US interface that we're inevitably coming into. Interesting piece in one of the papers today, Congressman Richard Neal arguing that Ireland has a really big role to play in all of that because of the soft power and influence that we have in the United States.
And a lot of skin in the game, given the presence of the European headquarters of a lot of these companies. Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin, and Michelle Murphy, research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Thank you all very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.